I have been having fun with Freedos on Bare Metal.
Okay. First of all, where did you get the floppy disks from?
You know me, Martin. I have floppy disks. I also have a lot of zip disks. I've been playing with zip drives as well. But I've loved the whole DOS aesthetic for years. You know, having grown up through my formative years with the 8-bit computers and then moved on to a PC and done some coding on MS-DOS-based computers, I've come to appreciate the code page 437 aesthetic, the, you know, double line boxes, single line boxes, the use of ASCII characters in, and the extended ASCII character set inside an 80 by 25 window. It's beautiful. I love it. I absolutely love it. And I recently stumbled on a video about a piece of software that I wanted to use. And it got me down a bit of a rabbit hole, as you do, you know, silly brain that decides to spend many hours doing a thing for a almost pointless activity. Yes, I'm sure you're familiar. But I mentioned that I did this on Bare Metal, and I've got some computers, some old computers. You may be aware of one or two ThinkPads that I have, a couple of which actually do run DOS. They're a bit old school. They're slow. They're old, and the other problem is getting files on and off them is actually a bit hard.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Because, you know, I've got a USB floppy drive, but that's slow, you know, so I could plug a USB floppy drive into my modern computer, put some files on it, and transfer across. I've also got a USB zip drive, so I could transfer 100 megabytes of data at a time. But it's all still a little bit, you know, insert disk here, pop it out, insert disk there, copy files. It's too retro for me. That bit I don't want to do, right? So I thought, why don't I just install DOS on a USB stick? And then, because it's on the USB stick, installed and bootable into DOS from the USB stick, I can just stick that USB stick in my desktop, copy all the files onto it that I want to, including games and other software, edit configuration files on my desktop in a modern graphical text editor, and then just plug that USB stick and boot from it in a computer that boots from USB, and I boot straight into DOS with my C drive full of stuff. It's wonderful. I absolutely love it.
Okay, I'm very confused. The USB stick, is that a floppy disk, or is that the C drive that boots?
Effectively, it's seen as the C drive. Once it boots, okay, that is C:\, and yeah, all your files are in there.
It has been such a long time since I've grappled with DOS. There's a lot of concepts here that have been pushed out of my brain.
Mm-hmm. They've been swapped out. Swap them back in again.
So how do you go about installing DOS on a USB stick?
Funny you should say that. You follow the installation guide on the FreeDOS website. It's all very clear. It's not that hard. You can put the installer on one USB key and install it onto another one. You could do that, or you could just unpack the image onto a USB, like you would unpack Ubuntu onto a USB stick. It's very similar. It's not hard. It's not particularly convoluted. And FreeDOS has a pretty decent installer these days that can enable you to install lots of additional packages. They're called software packages in FreeDOS. And FreeDOS is a bit more advanced than MS-DOS, and it's got some features that you would be familiar with from modern command line based operating systems that we're familiar with. That was all quite sweet, because it meant actually there's a couple of bonuses to this. The file transfer thing is good, because I can take the USB key, put it in my desktop, fill it up with stuff. The other thing is I can basically put it in any computer, and that computer becomes a DOS computer without interfering with what's on the hard drive in that machine.
Oh, wow. Okay. There's all sorts of useful applications here. So just so I've got this straight. So it's the hard disk, effectively. It's the thing that boots. It's the C drive. There's no floppy disk nonsense.
Yes.
The only caveat is you need a computer that is modern era enough that it has USB ports that are bootable.
Correct.
And then you're in business. How big is your USB stick? How big can the file system be?
Well, the USB stick I'm currently using is 8 gigabytes in size.
Okay.
Which, bear in mind, my very first PC had a 10 meg hard drive.
Mine was a 10 megabyte hard drive.
Right. Yeah. I mean, later on, I had bigger hard drives. Like, it went up to 300 and beyond that in the DOS era and then into the Windows era. But I can have more than one of these. I don't have to just have one USB stick. I could potentially have another stick, which is just full of games, and one that is full of applications, and just put FreeDOS on it, and I boot into FreeDOS, and I've got one optimized for games, or one optimized for applications, or whatever it is I want to play with that day.
Right. What file system are you using?
It's VFAT, so I can mount it on Windows, I can mount it on macOS, I can mount it on Linux, and transfer files to it. So it's very straightforward.
So one thing that hasn't been pushed out of my brain is the careful configuration of DOS high memory and upper memory blocks that I learned with great skill when DOS 5 came out. And it was something that I spent many years of my early career doing to multiple workstations around the office in order to keep them working harmoniously. Is that still a thing, or is FreeDOS more intelligent in the way it can manage memory?
Yes and yes, it is still a thing. And because some of the software you would want to install might use extended memory and some might use expanded memory. Mm-hmm. And yeah, come around the campfire and we'll tell you a story about that one day. Yes, but there are newer memory managers. There's one called JEMM, and that's free software and it's available on GitHub, and you can download a zip file that's got all the compiled binaries that work on FreeDOS. And FreeDOS actually ships with a menu that has, you know, do you want maximum expanded memory, maximum extended? Do you want a safe mode that has no drivers loaded? With a, you know, a very simple menu. You can customize that, obviously, because they're just text files you can edit in the root directory of your C drive or USB stick. So these were all things I was discovering while playing with FreeDOS and having fun getting back into that whole DOS world. But there is a bit of a flaw in the plan, in that most modern computers don't have SoundBlaster compatible audio hardware. They've got audio cards that have Windows drivers,
right,
but they're not familiar to DOS. Well, there's a solution to that. There's a piece of free software called SBEMU, which emulates a SoundBlaster card in DOS. And so you load a little driver once DOS has booted, just like you would load a mouse driver or a CD-ROM driver. And then it presents an interface so that your games, like Doom or whatever, think they're talking to a SoundBlaster card and they're going through this emulation layer and talking to the actual hardware. So I've got a modern-ish PC with a modern-ish chipset in it, and I'm able to play games that expect to see a SoundBlaster card for which there is no hardware in that machine.
So this driver actually implements actual driver support for a selection of common audio devices and then presents that as a set. That's so astonishing.
I know. It's amazing. Now, this has been around a while. I'm new to this, but this is stuff that's been around a while. And I know there are people very, very loudly shouting and typing emails at me right now, telling me you're an idiot. You should use DOSBox. You should just emulate. You shouldn't bother with all of this.
Mm.
And yes, there is a place for emulation. DOSBox is great. And I have emulators on all of my computers and I've got a Steam Deck full of them, right? But sometimes I actually quite like booting directly on hardware and using the hardware directly. And I've got no distractions. I've got no notifications or anything. I'm just sat there, single user mode in DOS, playing a game or writing some code or running an application. And it's quite satisfying and nostalgic at the same time.
So you mentioned playing a game there, and you also said emulators. I can only assume, given it's you have played games and used emulators. So what have you achieved in terms of gameplay on this?
So I've been playing some of my favorite games from the DOS era. I've only been playing with it a little bit, but, you know, obviously the classics like Doom and Friends. I've got a little trouble at the moment trying to get Wing Commander working because it crashes. I think there's something wrong with the way I've configured the memory, but that's something I can play with. And I know from looking online at the error messages that it presents that other people have similar kind of problems. You know, it just crashes with a memory exception error or something. But there's a very popular website for people who are enthusiasts about this kind of stuff called Vogons. And on the Vogons website, they talk about DOSBox and emulation, but also running DOS on real hardware. And there are often threads about what's the best modern computer to run, you know, old school DOS on. And bear in mind, this computer that I'm currently using actually still has an SSD inside it and still has an OS on the SSD, a modern OS, a modern, I say modern, it's Ubuntu 18.04, but it's got a modern-ish OS, but I don't interfere with that internal SSD at all. In fact, when I boot to DOS on the USB stick, it can't even see the SSD because obviously it can't, you know, it just can't see it. And so there's no danger to the internal OS, yeah. But it means on my keyring, I can have a USB stick with all the DOS classics and just plug it into a computer, boot up and start playing them. It's fantastic. I love it.
Well, you'll have to bring this USB stick into the office because I'm a bit of a Wing Commander hoarder and I have the complete box set collection of Wing Commander games, some of which I think are still in cellophane wrap that have never been opened.
I wouldn't sully your copy of Wing Commander by making you open it. But yeah, I'm quite enjoying this, especially the fact that I can fiddle with it within another computer, like just move files around. And like I updated the JEMM thing on my Windows computer. Now imagine how hard that would have been on a DOS computer, getting that zip file onto the computer, unpacking it. You know, it was just double clicked it in the file manager and dragged the files onto the USB stick and then plugged it in the computer and booted. And it's great. It's quite a nice experience.
It's a really nice solution. I like that a lot. And also, that's a total brain distraction, I fear, for my spare time in the coming days.
Yes, it was a nice change of scene.
I'm getting nervous about my server.
What's it planning to do to you?
My home server that I run things like Nextcloud on, and I've discussed various things I do with it on the show, is getting a bit long in the tooth. It's an HP ProLiant microserver N36L.
Ooh. That is ancient.
Which I think was the first generation micro server.
Yeah, it was. Did you get the £100 cash back when you bought it?
Yes. I remember we all got very excited about these when they were released because they cost something like 250 quid. But if you, within the right sort of 2 to 3 week window a month after you bought it, you could apply for £100 cash back from HP. So they actually worked out very cheap indeed for what they do. And I've basically had mine running ever since. And it's great. It's fine. It still works. But I can't help but thinking maybe I should replace it anyway. Now, my philosophy about hardware is always that, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Use what you've already got before you buy something new. I'm happy to repair stuff. I repair phones. I repair laptops before I throw them away at least a couple of times. But when I've got something like this, that's running all the time and running various services that I'm somewhat reliant on within my household. And I think, you know, if I was working for a company, that company would probably have some kind of hardware life cycle policy where every 4 years or so they would be refreshing their hardware. And maybe I shouldn't be gambling that this is going to keep running forever.
Well, if this podcast was to have a hardware life cycle policy, I've got good news for you, because I could help you upgrade to an HP ProLiant microserver N40L.
Okay, I can one up you here. I have behind me here an HP microserver ProLiant N40L and an N54L.
Right.
And they're not doing anything, so I may be able to help you, but you're only getting an extra, they only came out like a year or two later, so yeah. I'm not sure you're gaining a lot there.
Yes, you're getting a few extra megahertz, I think.
Right, so you've still got these machines, but you're not using them anymore. So you've replaced them, you've upgraded anyway. Do you have a sort of personal policy about how, you know, when you decide that it's time to upgrade, or is it just when something new and shiny comes out that you can afford?
So my N40L is on the top shelf up there, and it comes on periodically, and I sync everything from my main server to it, and it's like that third backup place that's absolutely unrelated. It's not on the network most of the time. I do it like twice a year, so it's kind of like just data backup in case something really bad happens to the other stuff.
So it's not the main server at all?
Not anymore. It doesn't have enough horsepower to do these servery things, but it's got four large disks in it and it can still store gobs of data.
Yeah, so I can't remember what triggered me to upgrade it. I think it might have been I saw someone online mention that the newer generation, I think it's called the Gen 8, that I have, which has a different look than the old microservice. The old ones are kind of black, very ThinkPad style, whereas the newer ones, the Gen 8s, are a little bit more modern looking and have a prettier chassis, but they're basically the same nuts and bolts inside with a faster computer, maybe with HP ILO as well added. And I can't remember what triggered it, but I upgraded to that. And that's the main one that's currently in the loft that does, is my Plex server, is my backup, is my Borg server. Mm-hmm. We talked about Borg, yeah, seems like eons ago. That's my Borg server.
Yeah.
And I don't have a plan to replace that at any time. But the two that have been relegated to sitting on a shelf and looking pretty, they're not doing anything at the moment.
Yeah. So I've cycled things through. As I've explained, this microserver's a not even a warm standby. My original NUC, which wasn't a NUC, it was a Gigabyte Bricks, which I got in 2012. That is my secondary home server. So that has backup critical services on it because it's low power and just sits in a corner. And my old NUC that was a workstation, I have repurposed as my server, and that is what's driving my new storage array. So like you, Mark, I sort of hand down old computers to repurpose and reuse themselves. And I love these microservers. And the only reason it isn't in daily service is the CPU is of a vintage that it can't do the things I want to do with a big server that takes, it takes quite a lot of power to drive all the disks and everything. And I can't do the things I'd want to do on such a big box, physically big box.
So it sounds like that your policy, rather than replacing stuff before it goes pop, is redundancy. Like you use the older hardware to provide redundancy for the newer hardware.
Yeah. And I had two of these microservers, and the other one is at my father-in-law's house and is their home server.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
So for a while, one of the microservers that I have was Ubuntu.social, the Mastodon instance, and only had one user, me, just because I was testing it out, making sure it all worked okay, and then I migrated to a server in the cloud. So I'm loath to do anything with it. Interestingly, having seen the topic that you put in the show notes, I did power it on just to make sure that it still works, and I plugged it into an external little display, and it still works. It's fine. It's not got a huge amount of space because it's got four 500 gig disks in it or something, spinning Rust. They're not SSDs or anything like that.
Yeah.
I could probably do something with it, but I just don't have a need for it. I've got enough computers to do stuff. There's nothing I need it for. And the Gen 8 that's in the loft is way faster than that. Much, much faster, especially with I/O. And so I've just moved everything to that.
And so for the systems that you do run as your primary systems, do you do anything to monitor those and keep an eye on when they do start to fail?
Yes. I used NetData for that.
And what does that collect for you?
It's quite nice in that it automatically enumerates everything that's in the system, both software and hardware, and automatically configures all the necessary time series data metrics. And once it's collated all of that, you can then just configure the ones you're interested in to fire off notifications if there's something you want a notification about. It is the lowest barrier to entry for, 'cause I used to do all this server and data center stuff as my day job, and it bores me silly now. So I just want the thing that is the simplest thing possible that just does the minimum that I need to make sure that when someone here wants to watch a film or look up some family photographs, it's there and it's working.
So it's interesting. I use something different. I use Telegraph, which I used to work on the Telegraph team, and it's just an agent. It's a single Go binary. They've got a repository, and so you could just apt install it. And it gathers data every however many seconds, 10 seconds on CPU, disk status, smart data, swap, temperature, everything. And it sends all that data to InfluxDB. And in InfluxDB, there's a dashboard, and I can see CPU, memory, graphs, charts. It's all pre-generated, templated stuff. So it's like, it's near zero effort to set up. You just enable a bunch of plugins in Telegraph once it's installed, point it at your Influx, and visit that on a regular basis to have a look, but I generally don't have a look. I don't look at alerts, so I don't really care that much, clearly. But I could configure alerts if I really wanted to and have it sent to Slack or Telegram or send me an SMS or an email if something went wrong.
So, Mark, you started this conversation by saying that this server was quite old and should you replace it? I suppose the question really is, does it do what you need it to do? Because I think the only thing I'd be cautious about, given its age, its vintage, is the quality of the hard disks. If the server can do what you actually need, it's got enough CPU and RAM.
I'd also worry about the power supply, because the power supplies in those do pop and they are unique.
Yes. So to the first point, the hard disks are, I think, the third generation of hard disks I've had in there. They're in a RAID array and I have been a bit more cautious. I've only had two actually fail, one because of a power cut and one just because I have replaced those completely twice, I think, in the lifetime of the server. The power supply is the big thing I'm worried about, to be honest. I'm really worried about that just going one day and me not being able to do anything about it. So short of tracking one down now and having it handy just in case, I feel like I'm going to maybe look at some of those tools you've mentioned and sometime over the next year, I think, consider whether I might want to have a replacement ready to go.
NeoFetch is dead. Long live FastFetch. And, as it happens, all the other fetchers.
So, NeoFetch is dead, is it? Or is it just dead to you?
No, it is actually dead. This came as a bit of a surprise. So, the NeoFetch project, if you look on GitHub, hasn't had any commits or updates for 2 years. And there's a backlog of hundreds of issues and hundreds of pull requests that I've just moribund. There's no activity on the project.
Isn't that just because it doesn't need to do much and it's finished?
Well, the hundreds of issues and pull requests would suggest there's still room for improvement. So, you know, there are new distributions to add logos for and all that sort of thing. There are rebrands of existing distributions. No, I think maybe the maintainer has just lost interest. Now, as it happens, this isn't why I went looking for an alternative, but I did go looking and I found a tool called FastFetch and it is fantastic. So I've switched over from NeoFetch to FastFetch, and FastFetch has a number of interesting attributes, not least it's actively maintained.
Meow.
But the other thing is it strives to actually sort of do everything that NeoFetch did and more. So when you just install it off the bat, it has a sort of a very familiar look to it, like the traditional unthemed NeoFetch. But it's implemented, I think it's C or C++, I don't forget, but it's one of the C's. And as a result, it is fast, as the name implies, unless you do some of the stats that it supports where you interrogate disks and what have you. And I have themed this thing, and it is beautiful beyond compare.
Sorry, can I just take a step back? Why does it need to be fast? Like, invariably, NeoFetch, in my experience, is a thing that people run once and then take a screenshot. They might resize the terminal or change the font size and like make sure they get the full name of the GPU in and the number of packages installed and get the font size readable, then take a screenshot and post it on Reddit, and that's it. That's all it's used for.
It's okay that you're wrong, and I'll explain why. So on my machines, when I log in, I have a minimal version of FastFetch run at login.
Okay.
To greet me as I log into different systems. So it being fast is quite good because it just is instantly available, whereas NeoFetch used to sort of have to draw and clunk its way through its rendering because it's implemented in Bash.
And so because you're drawing it every time you log into a machine, you want it to be fast, so you get to the prompt. And is there a side benefit that your aging brain can remember which machine you've SSH'd into by virtue of the fact that you're punched in the face with a logo and other stuff?
because I've themed FastFetch and I also used to theme NeoFetch, it greets me with my name and the host I've logged into and the operating system with a big logo. So yes, it just helps with that, you know, declining cognitive awareness.
Yes. Yeah, we're all there. Yes.
The other advantage is because it's fast and because it's themable, you can actually dump a whole lot of really useful information all in one go. So it's very much worth a look. I don't need to describe it anymore. If you're familiar with NeoFetch and ScreenFetch that came before it, and if you search on GitHub, there are dozens of NeoFetch replacements. Trust me, this is the only one that is maintained, works, and is like a superset of what NeoFetch could do. And it looks fabulous. You can use, I'm using fonts with glyphs and what have you in the terminal. So I've got nice pretty graphs and icons and what have you printing out alongside all of my metrics. It looks beautiful.
It has never struck me before today, before this moment, why it's called something fetch. And all of these are called NeoFetch, ScreenFetch, FastFetch. They've all got fetch and you call them fetches.
Yeah.
And it's never struck me, why is it called something fetch? And now I guess I know, because it fetches information about your computer.
Yes, and let me tell you about three other fetches that you want to add to your life.
Okay, go on then.
So, once I found FastFetch and saw how gorgeous it was, I wanted more of that in my life. So, the next one is called CPU Fetch. And when you run that, you get a nice ASCII logo of your silicon vendor. And a whole bunch of information about the CPU. So CPU fetch is a lovely addition to, you know, what you can display. If you want to go maximum terminal pretty, you know, this is another tool in the armory to just print out some basic information, but it looks great. It's also useful. And similarly, let me introduce you to RAM fetch. Which again, another pretty graphic in Technicolor ASCII that tells you all about the RAM configuration in your machine, including, you know, the current status of shared memory and buffers and all the rest of it. So between FastFetch, CPU fetch and RAM fetch, you can get quite a comprehensive overview of your system.
As well as showing the logo, does CPU fetch play the Intel boom, 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 boom tune? Or can it?
No, but you could totally create an alias to do that, couldn't you?
Yes, I would totally do that.
And then the last fetcher that I found is called OneFetch. And this one is really quite nice. So if you run OneFetch when you're inside a directory that has a Git project in it, it gives you a summary of that project. And it's pretty remarkable. So it tells you all the usual things that you want to know, like, you know, latest tagged versions of the repositories, how old the project is, branches that are active, all that sort of thing. But it also does a language inspection. So you know how NeoFetch and FastFetch display an ASCII logo of the distro that you're using?
Mm-hmm.
This works out the predominant language of the project and puts right. The language logo in the same way and all of the stats down the side. So I'm looking at one of my projects here and it tells me it's 96% Nix, 1.9% shell and 1.8% fish. And it tells you who all the authors are, broken down in a summary, the URL to the upstream, just a whole bunch of useful snapshot information. So I'm working on at the moment a hook for Git, which every time I step into a Git directory for the first time, it displays this. So it gives me an immediate refresh of what this project is and what branches are open and all of that stuff. So that's OneFetch. And we'll have links to all of those in the show notes.
Lovely.